Blog Talk Radio.
Ron Edwards, coming to you on Wednesday evening from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. As we indicated earlier this month, our co-host, Mr. Don Allen, is on academic assignment, if you will, trying to get more brain power. And so he clearly has not and will not be with us in the month of January. Martin Luther King, MLK, if you will, a time of the celebration of the life of a great American, a man of significant vision, nonviolence, and etc., whose life was tragically snuffed out by an assassin in the city of Memphis in 1968. Well, tonight we're going to take a look at a couple of specific situations that are of interest and concern to the African-American community across this country. One will be Flint, Michigan. The second will be a very high-profile incident, situation, circumstance that has created tremors here in the city of Minneapolis, and in fact across the entire Twin Cities metropolitan area. And that is the circumstances and the tragedy surrounding the death of Jamar Clark on the early morning hours of the 15th day of November in 2015, if you will. We're going to take a close look at the investigation, what is happening, what is not happening, and some concerns that have emerged with respect to the integrity of the investigation and the process, which has a lot to do with helping to maintain some level of stability here in the Twin Cities, in the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul. First of all, we want to say to our many friends who have called and asked if we were living in an igloo. People have been reading about the temperatures, if you will, of previous days. Things are beginning to warm up again. You know, we're halfway through the winter of 2015-2016, if you will. We had some below zero temperatures and wind chills. It's the wind chills, I think, that scares people. It starts dropping down to 20, 25. Up in northern Minnesota, in a place called Thief River Falls, Warro, up in that area, International Falls, and et cetera, there was at least one evening where the wind chill dropped down, the temperature dropped down to around 43, 44, below zero wind chill, if you will. That will make you stomp your feet and wish and hope that you have a warm, cozy spot, if you will. And Minnesota is still here. In fact, Minnesota will always be here. Minnesota went through this in the Ice Age, and it is still going through these circumstances of weather. Some call it climate change. I just call it good old-fashioned cold in the northern plains, if you will. Well, the people of the city of Flint, Michigan, a small city of 100,000, if you will, at one time a very prosperous city, a quote-unquote stopping point, if you will, for the lucrativeness of the automobile industry, General Motors, a legend in Flint, Michigan, as it, of course, is throughout the state of Michigan, and particularly in Detroit and et cetera. But as we said just seconds ago, Flint has fallen upon very hard times. And in doing that, it certainly cuts into your economic base. You start winding up with more poor people below the poverty line than you do people who are doing fairly well. And what has happened in the state of Michigan over the last couple of years is that primarily Republican governors and Republican legislatures have determined that certain cities shall be taken under the custody and control of the state, and certainly Detroit, Benton Harbor, Michigan, if you will, to a lesser degree, Muskogee, Michigan, and Flint, Michigan, fall into that particular category. The state, with the support of both the governor, who has the constitutional / legislative authority to do that, takes control of your city, appoints technically what is a special master. In this case, they call him a special administrator, who comes in, takes control of everything, even though, as happened in the city of Detroit, you're able to go through the democratic process, the electoral process of electing officials who really don't have any authority and control. And so this administrator, who is responsible to no one but the governor of the state, takes control of your city, begins to run things, puts things in place, if you will, always not to the best interest of the citizenry. Particularly, and unfortunately, if you are a city that has a extremely large number or a preponderance of African Americans as citizens of your city, as in the case of Detroit, and in the case of Flint, Michigan. In fact, I was talking with a person who, a former native of Detroit, talking in terms of how the population has slipped from almost, 1.6 million at one time in Detroit to a little over 800 and some thousand. Many areas of despair and et cetera in Detroit. Well, Flint, Michigan, same situation. One of the missions, one of the assignments that a special administrator has is to, quote-unquote, cut cost. And, of course, it's easier, I guess, to cut cost in a city that has a very large number, maybe even a majority percentage-wise, are citizens of color, African Americans. And so it's a little easier to cut services, if you will, to take away those assets which are important to maintaining the quality of life. I guess some people feel that it's not important for black people to have any semblance of quality of life. It's just be happy that you're not in shackles and ball and chain and et cetera. Well, that's what happened in Detroit, and definitely that's what happened in Flint. And in the case of Flint, though, some decision was made that there could even be a savings by creating a different, quote-unquote, protocol for water. Jeez, water is the most essential element, if you will, for the preservation of the human being / human body and et cetera. You know, if your water's bad, your life's going to be bad, and your health's going to be terrible, if you will. But I guess that wasn't taken into consideration a little over a year ago when the city administrator appointed by the state determined that they could save $19.1 million by changing the source of the city of Flint and, by extension, Genesee County, which Flint is the county seat. And so the Flint River, which has been a source of serious environmental contamination for quite some time, became the source. Well, a year ago, and we have a executive producer of our television program who was just in Flint just a month ago for the wedding of his son, who had said to us upon his return that the situation was bad in that city. The water was putrid, if you will, if you could call it that. It looked like oil sludge, and that there were beginning to be problems with health, and that some of the organizations and neighborhood groups in Flint were raising questions. But at that particular time, the governor and his associates, henchmen, whatever you want to call them, were saying that it was a confused population in Flint who thought that there were health problems that were emerging, particularly as it pertains to the babies. You see, the children are always innocent because they didn't vote for any of these people. They don't have a say as it pertains to how their lives are governed, as it pertains to these people. Children are kind of like a captive audience. But they're so important to the equation because they are the future, if you will. If you're concerned about the future, if you will, if you're concerned and committed to a continued reproduction, if you will. And so as children began in the summer of 2015 to display certain symptoms that were not conducive to a healthy environment, ecological system, ecology, all those kinds of things, it became disturbing. And a number of experts came in and said there was a problem. The governor finally begrudgingly a couple months ago said, that looks like we have some kind of natural disaster, catastrophe, or whatever, need to take a look at it. Well, it's now out in the open, and it was because of a very aggressive population that had great diversity, by the way, because white citizens of Flint and Genesee County, as well as African Americans, were suffering the effects of this problem, this environmental problem, and the illnesses that went with it. As we said before, our own executive producer of our television program here in the Twin Cities had indicated how bad it was. In fact, it's really driving the economic base in Flint, Michigan, into obscurity, if you will. The hotels really can't justify taking reservations. And people, certainly after they turn the tap on in their room and find out that not only can they not drink the water, but they're advised not to bathe in the water, shower in the water, and et cetera. So you know what that means for people who are permanent residents of Flint and Genesee County. And by this time, if you will, it was quite clear that there was a specific group of human beings, the children, who were being affected and infected to the extent that there should have been a state of emergency. It took a while. It took the mayor of the city of Flint to get on an airplane, fly to Washington, D.C., and appeal directly to the White House and to the president's chief of staff and advisors and et cetera. The governor, under pressure from other factions within the state of Michigan, finally called out the National Guard. But it was private organizations, such as the very strong and effective Muslim community in Detroit, as an example, who came to the rescue by making available and paying for hundreds of thousands of gallons of water, fresh water, if you will, non-contaminated water, to try to preserve the balance of normal life in the city of Flint. Now it has become a campaign issue, which is somewhat difficult to to understand in light of some of the things that all of the political pundits have taken up as issues on behalf of the American people. But finally, someone recognized that what was happening to the health and welfare of the citizens of Flint was something that needed to be assessed and dealt with as soon as possible. And so it has gone to the front page of most of our media, if you will. Discussions are going on. In fact, we heard an advertisement a couple hours ago on the radio television station, WCCO Channel 4, here in the Twin Cities, taking a look at the problems in Flint, Michigan, and that Pacific area, if you will. We just hope in a situation like that as a quote-unquote developed nation, we're not allegedly third world, though if you're an African-American in this country and you live in some areas of urban America, you think you're in a fourth class, if you will, nation with regards to what is not available to you and your family and your loved ones, everything from the lack of grocery stores to good health care, to transportation, and et cetera. But anyways, we all like to pat ourselves on the back and indicate that we are in a very sophisticated, developed nation, if you will, one of the richest, well, the richest on the face of the earth, if you will. Of course, don't keep your eye on the stock market with a great degree of frequencies, but it sounds good. You know, we hear all of the beautiful things. We see all of the beautiful people. And basically, we don't look behind the signboard, because if we look behind the signboard, unfortunately, we see the real America that is not as pretty as we would like to make others around the world feel that is present here in the good old USA. And so we tonight send our prayers and our wishes to the good people of Flint, Michigan, and Genesee County, if you will, but particularly we send our prayers to the children. As we said, they didn't have the opportunity to sit at the table with, you know, the big shots, if you will, and discuss their future, that being the children, their lives, their expectations, and etc. They didn't have that opportunity. That wasn't given to them. And regrettably, the statistics, the data shows that they are the most endangered group, the children. And so prayers go out to them tonight. And if you are in a safe area, if you will, and you are looking at your own lovely child, just kind of give them a hug and feel good about the fact that at least for now and on the surface, your babies are safe, if you will. Hopefully they are healthy, if you will. And hopefully they will live to enjoy a normal and fruitful life. And say a prayer along with your children for the children and the babies of Flint, Michigan. God knows that they need all the help that they can get. And we, as the learned and omnipotent ones, should feel terrible that we as a nation allowed this situation in Flint, Michigan and Genesee County to enlarge itself, if you will, to expand, to infect the lives of so many innocents that we are now at a point in time where we're looking at certainly a local emergency in the state of Michigan and in the city of Flint. God say a prayer for those that had nothing to do with the conditions and the turmoil that they now face. They had no voice, but they will certainly suffer the effects of the missed decisions, bad decisions, and political decisions of those who are always, that's us, who are always quick to remind children that we are the adults and that we speak with authority. I'm not sure that we think with the level of precision that we like to convey to our babies, but then we're the adults, and who is, quote-unquote, going to challenge us, if you will. Well, we also tonight want to move to a situation that is the elephant in the room here in the Twin Cities, and specifically the city of Minneapolis, and it has been, of course, the Pacific circumstance and event that we will be talking about tonight has certainly been on the forefront of the Fourth Estate, if you will, since the early morning hours of the 15th day of November 2015, at about 12:35, quarter to one, according to different reports and et cetera, when a 911 call was made for emergency vehicle as an outgrowth of something that was happening along the 1900 block or thereabouts on Plymouth Avenue North in North Minneapolis. And so when that emergency vehicle arrived, there had been a situation and an incident, a young woman who people tend to forget, I'm not sure that anyone has really looked in on her lately, had been injured as as an outgrowth of some kind of altercation in what was a party that was taking place in one of the apartments there in the small residential complex there along Plymouth Avenue. It escalated, as unfortunately situations have a tendency to do. A young man came to the ambulance as the medical personnel were attending to the young lady, demanding to be allowed to get into the ambulance, if you will, the emergency vehicle, maintaining that the victim was his mother. That was his initial statement, if you will. It was later refuted by the victim that she was not his mother, that she was someone else, and she did not feel comfortable with him being allowed into the ambulance. That has a history and a story in and of itself. At some point or another, the young man in question, a 24-year-old African-American at that time, returned back to the residency, if you will, where the gathering was taking place. The medical personnel ultimately had activated a emergency beacon inside of the ambulance, which is the equivalency to a 911 emergency call, and a patrol car assigned to the 4th Precinct of North Minneapolis ultimately arrived. The medical personnel, according to the records, information that has been forthcoming, identified by description an individual who had seemed to be threatening and a tad out of control. The officers went to the Pacific apartment there. How far they found it necessary to go into the home has not been necessarily made clear. It will be, I assume, at the point that the investigation is completed, if you will, in a full examination of all of the material facts are put on quote-unquote display and reviewed by whomever will review that, prosecutors, assistant prosecutors, and et cetera. But whatever the future was going to hold, the police felt that they had a situation in which they needed to take immediate action and brought the 24-year-old African-American back out, coming down a short sidewalk, walking back towards Plymouth Avenue and directly across the street from the Ames Lodge, the Elks, as some call it, a part of the International Benevolent Order of Elk, if you will, one of our fraternal organizations. There were already some people, this is important also, there were already some people outside of the Elks that was separate from those that were in the apartment complex and apparently in what was a small gathering slash party. At some point, as the officers were moving back towards the street and obviously towards their patrol car, something happened. What specifically it is, once again, we all are waiting for the information, for the reflections, if you will, for the evidence, and of course for the witnesses and the testimony. But whatever happened, a scuffle broke out between the two police officers and a man later to be identified as Jamar Clark. In the course of these events, to the timeline would probably be 2 minutes, maybe 2.5 minutes, probably no more than that, if you will. A scuffle takes place. All three individuals seem to fall to the ground, if you will, with one of the officers having, quote-unquote, a chokehold on the now defendant slash suspect, if you will. Struggle kind of continues, and then all of a sudden, a shot, a single shot is heard. At that point, and you normally have this, unfortunately, a situation in an area in which there are numbers of people, there are screams, you know, there are shouting, there are curses, and etc. By that time, certainly one of the officers had called for officer needs assistance, may have even said officer down, if you will. And, of course, by that time, though it is indicated that there were at least two additional squads that were en route based on the call that had come in from the emergency vehicle, the ambulance, if you will. So within a very, very short time, according to information and testimony as it pertains to documents that were then filed, even as early as by 8 o'clock on Sunday morning, upwards of 17 to 18 police vehicles came into the area in question. At that point, it was, of course, noticed that Mr. Clark was laying on the ground, some say face down, some say on his back face up, though people later, much later, 6 to 7 hours, were saying that he was handcuffed, and he had been handcuffed, which meant he was handcuffed when he was brought from the apartment towards the police car and the ambulance. That will certainly be in dispute. It is in dispute, if you will. But he, for all practical purposes, was deceased. And what had happened is that the shot that had been heard had penetrated his head area, if you will, probably killing him instantly, if you will, particularly given the caliber of weapon, a 9mm. It's a rather large projectile striking you anywhere in the head. But that Mr. Clark was non-responsive, normally the term that you use when a situation has reached that level. Of course, by that time, crowds had gathered. People had come out of their apartments throughout the complex, but also equally important was that the Elks, which had a pretty decent-sized crowd on a quote-unquote Saturday going into Sunday, early Sunday morning, was starting to let out. People were looking across the street, though, in many respects, from the location of coming out the door and looking across the street, if you will. It would have been difficult to determine the actual circumstances and situations of the now deceased, if you will. Of course, understanding that there were already medical personnel on scene attending to the injuries of a young female who, quote unquote, had been the initial person called for and had herself been a victim of circumstances and situations in which she had received injuries. By this time, a perimeter, of course, is set up. Police call for the crime scene investigator, CSI, as popularly known, if you will. And the authorities began to take control of the area. This comes at a time when just down the street there is a precinct station, if you will, though it Saturday night is always a busy night, a lot of concentration, though, in November. Mid-November of 2015, it was on the safety of downtown, so a lot of patrols, even in the 4th Precinct and the 1st Precinct, which is the downtown precinct, were in close proximity to downtown, though the crowds were still about an hour away from the clubs letting out. The fact of the matter is that there had been concerns expressed about the downtown council and the Chamber of Commerce about quote-unquote conditions in downtown that were not conducive to good, quote-unquote, profit and business practices, if you will. But returning to Plymouth Avenue across from the Ames Lodge, the crowd had gathered. Later, of course, the medical examiner, who in a situation like that basically takes their good time. But this was an officer-involved shooting. There were a couple things at that particular point that were disturbing. One was that apparently the fourth or fifth squad car and officers had arrived, helping to secure the area. Of course, by this time, everyone now admits that Mr. Clark was handcuffed, which 2 months later, in a copyrighted story in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, many Minnesotans discovered what persons such as myself have known for years and years and years, is that people who are involved in altercations with the police are always handcuffed, if you will, even if they are in the final stages of death or if they are severely injured and et cetera. And particularly if you are a person of color, you are pretty much guaranteed that you will be handcuffed and put under custody and control. That's called C&C, if you will. But the officers found or saw in the grass a pair of handcuffs, if you will. Now, whose handcuffs they were is certainly a matter that I assume the investigators are going to highlight in their final report, I assume. But clearly, these handcuffs were certainly not the handcuffs that were on Mr. Clark, which meant that one of the two officers who were the initial engagers with Mr. Clark had lost their handcuffs, which then raises the question of the handcuffs that were on Mr. Clark and how that situation could have happened. Now, as we said before, by that time, calls were continued to go out that the crowd had become unruly, if you will. This was not a good situation based on circumstances and conditions and events that had been taking place in the Twin Cities for quite some time, maybe going all the way back to the shooting death of Terrence Franklin in the basement of a home on the south side of Minneapolis a couple of years ago. By the way, that particular matter is allegedly being certified as being ready for trial in November of this year. That's kind of interesting. Normally the federal courts don't let something language for that significant period of time. The feds usually like to get you in, get the trial going, and get you out, if you will. That's Uncle Sam's level of significant proficiency in the world of justice. But at some point, of course, the medical examiner arrives. People were saying on transmissions, electronic transmissions, that the victim was still alive, had been taken to the hospital, and et cetera. That information did not seem to be consistent. Now we move into the very early morning and the hours, 4 or 5 o'clock of November 15th. Now people are running about the area. Calls are being made to some in the public safety and law enforcement arena indicating that they have knowledge and information. The events surrounding the death of a 24-year-old African-American. How accurate those reflections were during that period of 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning. But by 9 o'clock, of course, the officers have been, in fact, the officers were transported almost immediately to room 108 in City Hall, room 108, legendary for the place that you go if you're a police officer involved in a situation in which there has been the discharging of a weapon or et cetera. And there your union representatives show up. Oh, that's important, by the way. And you are required to give a series of tests of blood and urine to determine, you know, that you were in full control of your faculties as a law enforcement officer. That, again, is room 108. Later, testimony or certainly reporting indicates that the head of the powerful police federation, Lieutenant Kroll, immediately rushed to City Hall and the room 108. And there a interrogation began officers are encouraged to discuss with their Federation representative and others, if you will, who have been appropriately certified to discuss the events. In fact, some maintain that that's where the statement was developed that Mr. Clark had attempted to wrestle the gun from the holster of one of the officers, if you will, and that as an outgrowth of that, it was necessary for a second officer in defense of his comrade, his partner, to draw his weapon and fire a single shot into the head of Mr. Clark. Now, this is the narrative, if you will. This is the scenario that would have to be in play with regards to the events taking place in room 108, let's say between the hours of about 2 and 7 a.m. on the morning of the 15th day of November. Now, by 10 or 11 o'clock, people have gathered at what now has become a memorial site on one hand, a crime scene on the other. A lot of discussion is going on. Black Lives Matter. Representatives of the NAACP are now present. A lot of discussion going on. The commander of the 4th Precinct, of course, has arrived. He is a hands-on commander. He is certainly attempting to ascertain what has happened and at the same time reach out. By this time, leadership of the NAACP, Black Lives Matter, are maintaining that there are at least a dozen, if not more, two dozen, in fact, at some point in time, according to Minnesota Public Radio, Star Tribune, and others, Nakibe Alebe Pounds, the president of the Minneapolis branch of the NAACP, as well as the leader, the titular head of Black Lives Matter, is saying that as many as 25 witnesses have taken videos of the actual scene, if you will. In fact, maybe around 5 o'clock a.m. on Sunday, a person who is identified as a community, quote-unquote, activist and et cetera, a female, actually calls and maintains that they were at the scene. They were there when the shot was fired. Within seconds of the shot being fired, they turned and observed Mr. Clark on the ground, if you will, surrounded by the officers. Another person indicated that they had observed one of the officers, the smaller of the two officers, I'll let you figure that out, my friends, had placed his quote-unquote foot on the chest of the soon-to-be-deceased Mr. Clark and had fired a single shot into his head, if you will. I mean, so the stories were quote-unquote rampant, if you will. Folks were indicating that we had now seen our Ferguson, because for almost a year since Ferguson, Missouri, there had been those that indicated we were just one pistol shot away from Ferguson. And then, of course, they enhanced that and indicated we were now just one shot away from Baltimore, if you will. And so there was much tension. In the meanwhile, though, the police officers were with their legal representatives. They were in the process of, quote-unquote, giving their statements, as we said earlier, submitting to the necessary testing of blood, if you will, in urine, to determine that that they were not of an unstable condition at the time of the confrontation. By 1 or 2 o'clock p.m., about 12 hours after the shooting of Mr. Clark and the announcement of his death and et cetera, you know, folks were organized. They were on the move. They were indicating this would not be tolerated, that we now have our Ferguson, if you will. We now have our Baltimore. We now have our Cleveland, if you will. We now even have our New York City. And so the rest of the day of Sunday, there was much discussion, much reflection, and et cetera. By this time, the mayor and other political leaders in our beloved city had begun to talk in terms of the process, if you will. Process is always important, particularly over the last number of years in this country, as so many African Americans, male and female, have been the victims of police shootings, if you will, and then investigations that by and large would probably be the exception of North Charleston, South Carolina, wind up going nowhere. But the anticipation that something was about to explode, of course, was well-founded, and of course we all know what happened in the remainder of the month of November and into December, where organizations were able to acquire a national level of attention and et cetera. And then with that attention goes a label, and that label indicates that they are part of the new movement of leadership, of young leadership, aggressive leadership that is setting the tone for what is to happen in our beloved Shangri-La. And so within a number of days, people are talking and et cetera. Now, on the 17th day of November, this commentator was contacted, in fact, by two people that maintained that they were witnesses to the death and the circumstances surrounding Mr. Jamar Clark. We were asked if we would lend our expertise. We unfortunately have been involved for many, many years, going all the way back to the 1960s and some of these shootings and tragedies. And of course, we were very much involved in that particular situation in Eagan, Minnesota, where we came the closest of, at any time in the history of this state, of a indictment against a law enforcement officer for the death of an African American in the death of Eric Benford, the son of the, at that time, the city's civil rights director, Mr. Robert Benford, who actually later died of a broken heart. Eric Benford's aunt died of a condition brought on by both asthma and a failing heart. She died within 2 weeks after Eric Benford was shot and killed by an Eagan police officer at a filling station in that southern suburb. So we, this commentator, has been very much seasoned, if you will, of what happens. Sal Saran Scott, if you will, head blown off there on 7th Street in North Minneapolis and Oak Lake there by the bus garage. Tysail Nelson, young man gunned down, if you will, at a party on a house just off of Plymouth and Bryant, if you will, in that particular area, Emerson, more like. We've seen other situations and circumstances. So we are certainly, as both a historian and a journalist and et cetera, well-seasoned with regards to these tragic events. And so the process began. Much discussion, demands that the Minneapolis Police Department, under the leadership of Chief Janae Harto, and certainly under the civilian leadership of Mayor Betsy Hodges, yield their quote-unquote authority to have investigated the shooting, and began a process which had been under discussion for about over a year, pertaining to an outside entity. Actually, we wound up with two. We wound up with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which really, as quiet as it's kept, has never really had a history of having a very intimate relationship with the communities of color, not even the Native Americans on the reservations in northern Minnesota and central Minnesota and et cetera, and certainly not much of a reputation with experience with African Americans and et cetera. But anyways, political decisions were made, and within certainly a matter of days, it was announced that the MPD had agreed that the investigation should be handled by an outside entity. Now, it was at this point that this commentator was approached on the 17th day of November. One of the witnesses, who, by the way, for purposes of authenticity and et cetera, we still have the text message from them, and that includes their telephone number and name, decided that they would take the advice of members of the ecumenical community at that time and not come forward. We were saddened by that. But we had another witness who approached us during the midday of the 17th, indicated that their name had been made available to the authorities as a person who was on scene, if you will. By the 19th of November, this person was being asked if they would come in for an interview. They indicated that they would have to have representation. They did not feel comfortable with coming in and meeting with authorities. Within, by the way, a couple of hours of the announcement, we had now our dual agencies, and that would be the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and, of course, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. By Friday the 20th, this witness had agreed upon a time certain, and on the following Monday, according to the records and documentation, this witness came forward, stand-up person, having information, having seen the event, the tragedy, from its initial stages, if you will, wanted to give testimony to what it was that they had seen. A meeting was arranged, if you will. There were four persons who were in this meeting. The witness, who, of course, is extremely crucial. The two investigators, one from the state, one from the federal authorities, and a special advisor to the witness, who happens to be this commentator. Meeting took place. It was quite obvious to me, and let me say this now as we move into the last 13 minutes of tonight's program, that the state's representative, who I have to assume really doesn't have a lot of experience dealing with African Americans, if you will, was really not comfortable with the witness, who, of course, is an African American. The FBI's representative was a younger person, if you will, very much laid back, very professional in how they dealt and their interactions. And so the examination began, and in the course of the examination, in which there was a tape recorder positioned, if you will, both investigators had their notebooks out and were writing. Witness laid out the narrative. This witness, in fact, was approximately 15 feet from the incident, if you will, directly, quote unquote, across the street. At some point, moved into the street when the struggle started, if you will. Saw specific situation. Saw the combat going on, though he indicated to the investigators that it was pretty one-sided. Mr. Clark was not a very large man, if you will, and of course it appears that he may have been drinking a tad, if you will. Both of the officers well-conditioned, well-trained individuals in hand-to-hand combat, if you will, basically overcame and subdued Mr. Clark rather quick. Now, I'll do it this way. In the course of the interrogation, if you will, at a facility in North Minneapolis, this witness indicated that at some point in time, Mr. Clark was not conscious. And it was interesting to watch the body language of particularly the state's chief investigator, because you could see it written all over his face that that was a real problem as it pertains to the testimony of this witness, which implied, by the way, that Mr. Clark was unconscious at the time that he was shot. which then raises all kinds of questions with regards to what really happened during that brief struggle. The investigator, particularly for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, asked numerous times, 15 different ways, for the witness to indicate what happened. At one point, the witness actually dramatized how the officer was controlling Mr. Clark and et cetera. I thought did it extremely well, was concise with their information, if you will, and continue to indicate using a specific term, not anything profanity and et cetera, but identifying what the physical confrontation and conditions were. The meeting ultimately ended. It was probably over 35 to 40 minutes, if you will. And the witness was given the cards of both the state and federal investigators, if you will. I have to say that the state investigator specifically was not happy that there was a outside party present. And in many respects, we were probably glad that we were, based on then later what happened. Sometime around the first or second week there, about in December, one of the investigators engaged in a conversation with a member of the Minnesota judiciary, if you will, and in the process discussed the case and began to malign the witness, a very crucial witness, because what the witness indicated as an example that was taking place was later reinforced, and this would have been a situation in which this witness would not have had access to that particular information when a local alternative newspaper here in the Twin Cities reported, quote-unquote, the history of one of the officers in another jurisdiction in California, San Diego, where this officer had worked and where this officer had gained a reputation as it pertains to some of his physical, quote-unquote, combatant styles and et cetera. We repeat that again, that this witness gave specific clarity to the fact of what it was that they had observed during the final moments of the life of Mr. Clark. Now, we, in summation, cannot understand why it was necessary for one of the investigators to malign this important witness, a community person, if you will, who came front and center to provide, quote-unquote, information in the quest for justice. But it happened. One of the other situations that happened is that this witness was never recontacted. We are now into middle January, if you will. This witness has not been reached out to. Some of our associates and friends have indicated that, you know, that the witness should not expect that they will see their statement and et cetera. We don't agree with that. We know of situations where you are at least allowed to determine if, in fact, accurate information has been put down on paper that you allegedly said, and that it is commensurate and consistent with the tape recording and et cetera. We repeat again, this very crucial witness who watched the final moments of the life of Mr. Clark ebb away, if you will, who gave specific detail to the events leading up to that fatal sequence of actions and et cetera, was never recontacted. In fact, there is reason to believe that there is no report, particularly in light of the conversation that one of the investigators had with a member of the Minnesota judiciary, blasting, maligning, and questioning the credibility and the integrity of the witness, and also making a statement which at this point we will not share with the general public. But we are prepared, in closing, to share the events that we saw with the federal grand jury, because we think that it has reached that point. We think, in light of the conduct of agents of the state of Minnesota, that it is important that a request be made to the Department of Justice for the appointment of a special prosecutor. And the purpose of that prosecutor would be to come here from somewhere other than Minnesota and to take control of the total investigation, to impanel a grand jury, a federal grand jury. I understand what Black Lives Matter and others have said, bypassing the grand jury process in a situation like this just is not going to work. We would encourage that tonight on this program, as we move into the last minutes of this program. We would encourage the appointment in light of the statements and in light of the evidence and information that is at hand, that a special federal prosecutor be appointed by the Attorney General of the United States, and that that official take up immediate authority and responsibility. See, one of the problems that's going to come up is how an investigation is going to take place with regards to the fact that now one of the individuals involved in, quote-unquote, the violation of the due process and constitutional rights of not only the police officers, but the search for truth and justice in the case of Mr. Clark, that you're going to have to, quote-unquote, demand that a member or members of the Minnesota judiciary step forward and give testimony in a situation that may involve a client-attorney relationship. I repeat that again, a client-attorney relationship. We are saddened by the fact that it has come to this. We weighed heavily, particularly in consultation with the witness, who certainly does not deserve what has been laid against them by the investigators. If they really wanted to do this, they were absolutely, totally, unequivocally committed to step forward and et cetera. We call upon the civil rights organizations and all of those who indicate that they are on point, if you will, that they are about the business of bringing order and justice and et cetera. We call upon them to join, like a chorus, in requesting now that a special federal prosecutor, not someone appointed by Andy Lugar and et cetera, but taken up by the Department of Justice and the Civil Rights Division, and if necessary, that the action be initiated by the Attorney General of the United States. We have too many, in closing, of these situations and circumstances that are taking place in our country in which the rights of the victim and then by extension the community are not being protected. But at the same time, we want to protect the rights of the police officers. And what has happened in this entire scenario is that their rights have also been infringed upon. There needs to be a thorough examination under color of law. We are not suggesting anything tonight that is outside of the purview of the provisions of color of law. And so we will be back next week with some additional reflections. It will be interesting to see who is prepared to mount the challenge to make sure that justice is guaranteed for all parties concerned. To do anything less is to defeat the purpose of our institutions and the quest for justice. We appreciate the opportunity to be with you this evening. In closing, this is your host, R.A. Edwards. We will be back with you next week. And again, our colleague, Mr. Allen, will be joining us on the first Wednesday in February. Again, Martin Luther King and Black History coming up next. We think that there's a lot of history out there that needs to be discussed. Again, I'm Ron Edwards. This is the Don and Ron program coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Good evening.